This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Dozens of activists and others are on a mission in Central and North America right now. They're on a caravan for peace, life, and justice, traveling through Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, and eventually the United States. In the U.S., the caravan will head to New York later this month for the United Nations General Assembly special session on drugs. The issues motivating the travelers are the violence of the drug war, the mass deaths and disappearances, the undermining of democracy, and the exodus of refugees. One of the members of the Caravan for Peace, Life, and Justice is my guest, Laura Carlson. She is the director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy and a columnist for Foreign Policy and Focus. She is usually based in Mexico. Now she joins us live from a cyber cafe in Guatemala City. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you, Sonali.
Tell us about your travels. Now, I understand that you started in Honduras, and of course, this happening in the wake of the murder of Berta Cáceres, a country still reeling from her death. What did you sort of find in Honduras?
Well, Honduras was fascinating. We began on March 28th, on Monday, in Tegucigalpa, the capital city, where we had a press conference and met with human rights groups there, almost all of which, of course, had worked with Berta Cáceres. She was, in fact, one of the main organizers of the caravan in the work that we did prior to actually setting off with this group. She was very strongly behind it because her organization, the Civic Council of Popular Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, strongly believes that the drug war in Honduras and in other places as well has been a pretext to militarize. And then when the indigenous people launch their battles to recover or to maintain, defend their lands and territories, of course, that militarization that's in place and supported by the United States has frequently been used against them. And they've seen that directly in Copin. This was the primary reason that Berta was so supportive of this project. It was a tremendous loss for everyone, her assassination, a tremendous injustice. And what we were able to see in Honduras is that there are very low hopes that there's actually really no hope that the Honduran government would really bring this crime to justice. So there's strong call for an independent coalition. From there, we went out to the Atlantic coast, the Caribbean coast, with also a very strong grassroots organization called Ofrané. And this is a Garifuna, an indigenous organization, that's located in the communities, and it's also involved in a lot of battles for the defense of territory. And they're very supportive of the caravan for the same reasons that the militarization has hurt them, the increased violence because of this war on drugs approach led to the assassination by the naval forces, actually, of two Garifuna youth last year. And in the same region, we had the massacre of a WASP, which was actually a DEA State Department helicopter that fired on local residents, killing four of them. Another crime by the state that has been unsolved. So we've come along now with two COPIN members and five members from the Garifuna community as we begin to add more and more people along the route of the Caravan for Peace, Life, and Justice.
So as you're going through these countries, people are joining you. I mean, in a way, Laura, Berta Cáceres' murder and the murders of the Garifuna that you were mentioning and all of the violence, I mean, that is the reason, that is the underpinning for why this caravan is, you know, trying to draw attention to the violence, right? I mean, in a way, it's just a horrific display of the very issues that Berta was fighting for that ended her life.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's not a perspective that people immediately think of when they're talking about drug policy reforms. For the New York United Nations meeting, people are more focused on whether they should reschedule marijuana or begin to open up legalization options. And these are important parts of alternative solutions without a doubt, because it's the US especially prohibition policies that have led to these militarized enforcement measures that are costing so many lives within our countries. But people don't realize that these enforcement, prohibition enforcement measures are at the root of the violence, particularly these countries we're going through, which are in Central America, the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and of course Mexico, and going into the United States, where mass incarceration is the primary problem as a result. It creates this huge repressive apparatus. And when you talk to the people from the organizations in these countries, almost invariably what they begin by saying is this supposed war on drugs is really a pretext for a war on us, a war on our families, a war on our movements.
Now, Laura, the path that your caravan is taking, does it in a way parallel the path that Central American migrants, refugees of the drug war, if you will, take to get to the United States, and often having to pass through Mexico, a very dangerous area for them?
Yes, absolutely. And it's one of the other issues that we're looking at, and we'll be looking at it particularly tomorrow when we cross the Guatemala-Mexico border, because a part of this crackdown on drugs with these militarized police forces and millions and millions of dollars going to Mexico and the Central American countries is also a crackdown on the borders and on migrants that is also costing the lives and the disappearances of migrants along the way. So we have a vicious circle for many of these people where, because of the increased violence with the increased repression of the state and the destabilization of an illicit drug trade, they're forced out of their own countries, whether it's Honduras, El Salvador, or Guatemala. They're sent on this exile refugee trail. They meet with increased repression on the Mexican border. Some are deported back. Some are murdered when they come back because they were already under threats and they were not given the proper protections of refugee status. Some continue on. They face repression again on the U.S. border, where this conflation of border security, counterterrorism, which is just kind of a bad joke because there's no international terrorist threat from this region, and counter-narcotics has created, again, a buildup, a crackdown along the border. And if they're lucky enough to get into the United States as undocumented workers, they face all the problems that go along with being hunted down and being denied their basic rights. So it's an issue that comes in.
There's so many intertwining issues here at play, which is actually appropriate that you're traveling through all of these countries on this caravan. One of the things that while your caravan has been happening, in addition to Berta Cáceres' horrific murder, we've had a couple of revelations, and I'm wondering if you can even reflect on that and whether they are related to your caravan. One is, in addition to Cáceres' murder, the revelation of this person who claims to Bloomberg, Andres Sepulveda, the man who says that he was involved in hacking a number of elections in Latin America. And the other is the Panama Papers, which implicates many heads of state in Latin America and, of course, heads of state around the world. And in a way, we've seen sort of the exposure of how power works and the, you know, the kinds of corruption that is, again, linked back to the violence.
Yeah, exactly. So if we start with the Panama Papers, which is in all the newspapers now, what we see there is that this illicit, first you have prohibition that creates an illicit market, which criminals have to run. And it also creates these extremely high, completely unregulated flows of illegal money. These flows of illegal money are a pillar of the legitimate financial system and of operations such as this law firm that got hacked and the banks that
Mossack
are operating
Fonseca.
In Panama.
Right, this is the Panama-based law firm Mossack Fonseca.
Right, with these incredible client lists, right? And so the other part of it that really has drawn our attention, and mine particularly as an analyst on this issue for many years, is that while they're spending all this money for U.S. contracts to defense industry, to Blackwater's security firms, whatever name they're operating under currently, and mostly U.S. contracts, to really crack down in these Central American countries. When you look at the amount that's being spent on the financial crimes that are invariably involved with this illegal business, it's a tiny fraction. So you have a protection of a huge chunk of the industry. You have a crackdown that's actually coming across as a crackdown on popular movements, much more than on drug cartels themselves in the countries that are dedicated to the production and the transit, especially in the global South. And you have this huge, huge degree of corruption. I've heard several people, when they talk about the Drug Enforcement Administration, say, why do you think it's called an administration? You know, there's no reduction in the flow of drugs. There's nothing changing in terms of the illicit business. And what's actually happening is an administration of how that business takes place and who benefits from it. So this world of corruption has come into play. You know, it's not talked about near enough when we talk about drug policy and when we talk about the drug war itself, but it's central, and there's some very, very powerful interests that that want the drug war to continue because it doesn't touch the business, and it creates this whole other arena of a war industry.
Right. It keeps in place a policy, a sort of set of realities that benefit elites. Now, Laura Carlson, by the way, is joining me from an internet cafe in Guatemala City. Guatemala is one of five countries that she and others are traveling through as part of the caravan that we are discussing. And each of these countries, of course, has their own sort of unique set of issues with some commonalities. And we talked about Honduras. In the United States, we're well aware not only of how immigrants are targeted and deported or detained, but also how people of color are imprisoned for drug-related crimes and mass incarceration. But what about the, and Mexico, of course, which you're heading next, we have the mass violence at the border or near the border. But focus a little bit on El Salvador and Guatemala. Yeah. What are the issues of these two countries that often get short shrift?
Yeah, well, it has been a lot for us to think about because kind of the focus, there's so many victims of this war for so many different reasons. And the focus does change drastically, and also because of who we're working with in each country. So we go from what are mostly the land and territory struggles in Honduras and enter into El Salvador, where the issue at hand is the violence related to the gangs. And there it's been a crash course in learning the many of the church organizations, excuse me, and others that we've been working with are saying that it's necessary to take this new public health approach to drugs and to the drug war, because this repressive model, again, which is being reinstated in El Salvador and is actually behind this incredible increase of homicides that we've seen in the last year and a half or so that contributed to the unaccompanied minor crisis, is not working. It's increasing the violence, the gang violence and the security force violence. And in between, people are trying to say, we've got to think of something else. We've got to find ways to look at the public health aspects to kind of ratchet down this militarization and the emphasis on the guns, on the arms, on this macho mentality of who's going to eliminate who. That's been such a huge cause of the violence. But the basic tendencies, what's behind it is very much the same, this militarist macho mentality. And the what we're looking at here is not just who are the victims of it, but what forms of resistance, what forms of alternatives are already taking place that can be expanded on if there's an opening up of a little bit more policy space to look at alternatives.
And Laura, what do you and others hope to do in New York, your final destination, when you get to the United Nations, to this meeting, General Assembly meeting on drugs? You mentioned earlier that the kinds of policies they're considering are just kind of chipping away at the edges of the drug war. But how will the caravan confront the meeting? Will you be allowed into the meeting? Do you have any plans for people to speak at the meeting? And specifically, what would you want the UN to do?
Well, there are plans. I mean, there are people who are on the list, but in the end, it's United Nations. It's the meeting itself that decides who speaks or not, and we still don't even know about that. But since the beginning of the caravan, our expectations for actually influencing the decisions that come out of that UN meeting have been relatively low. It's not the primary objective of the caravan. There's a momentum, and it's an economic and a political momentum that directly benefits not only the people involved, but the people indirectly involved in the drug war to keep this thing going. It's the reason that over 40 years after seeing failure after failure of this repressive model, the governments continue to not only replicate it, but to dedicate more and more resources and intensify it, as we've seen in our travels in this region. So instead of that, the idea, the purpose of the caravan has always been to open up a dialogue and to create pressure from civil society in all these countries, and even more so as they begin to join together across borders, to say civil society has a right to have a say in these issues. You're creating a drug regulation format, you know, a regime on an international level that has extremely negative effects for us. We have a right to have a say in these issues, and we have a right to create a voice. So the caravan is raising those voices. It's introducing people across national lines, despite the different angles of entry to the issue and the different focuses that they're working with, in the hopes that this will create a more united voice to eventually get to a point where both on the national and international level, the laws can begin to change. At the same time, some of the grassroots movements have been able to carve out their own autonomous spaces to begin to fortify other responses as well.
Laura, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us today, and good luck on the rest of the caravan.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
Laura Carlson is the director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. I'll see you next time.